Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line.
That's a song that Rolling Stone magazine put at number 30 on a list of greatest songs ever. I think it ought to be higher up the list, but that's just me. Today, we're taking a break from the nonstop politics, and we're talking about the way we experience music. It's a conversation that I started in the spring with New York Times music critic Ben Ratliff after his book Every Song Ever came out. Here's what Ratliff told me when we talked about how music forms our self-image.
Music moves. It's always in motion. It's always running away from you, and you are trying to interact with it. I just think that music is, you know, a deep part of the formation of our personalities, how we walk and talk and think and love.
Today, three people in the studio who love, play, and make music. And your thoughts via social media, too. What's the song that turned you into a music listener? The song that you associate with an important experience in your life? You can tweet me, at Carrie NPR. Our roundtablers today, Chastity Brown is a singer and musician with Red House Records. She headed out west on tour at the beginning of October. Welcome back. Really good to have you on the roundtable.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Jovante Patton is a gospel singer with a new album called Finally Living that came out in July. Welcome to the roundtable. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
And Michael Koppelman is a former audio engineer at Paisley Park, entrepreneur, and now he's into beer, drinking it and making it at Badger Hill Brewing. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Chastity, one of the things that Ben and I talked about was whether the emotional experience of music diminishes because music is everywhere and accessible at any time and isn't something that is as set aside, I guess, for those special moments of listening. It just surrounds us.
Yeah, I feel like maybe the way in which we receive it has changed, but the depth at which we experience it. I work with teenagers, and what gets to them, it's still, I can still see it really resonate at a deep level. So, I feel that even though it is everywhere and it's permeated through all these different social medias, we still all crave that thing that just like gets us, whether it gets us like up and out of the house in the morning or gives us a good cry, you know? So,
Michael, what do you think? Everywhere, and in places I think where we're even unaware of it, is the specialness kind of gone?
I sort of think of it like once we are, the spotlight of our attention goes on music, we get just as much out of it as anyone ever has.
You mean when you're paying attention to it?
Right. Yeah. So the background noise of it sort of being constantly there, I don't think distracts from that. You do find music that might move you or change you in unlikely places because of that, at the end of a movie or something, or, I don't know, in this supermarket where you're exposed to something and it, you go track it down. Like, so maybe there's an upside. I don't know. Like, I think people need to listen to music with their brains and more than just as background music.
But I don't think we do as much of that.
Seems like we almost never do.
I remember the days, Jovante, maybe you did this too, where you'd sit there either with the CD or the album cover or the liner notes in front of you, and you would do that with a friend, and that was a kind of meaningful experience. I never, ever do this, mainly because I'm not listening to CDs,
that's
right?
True. We used to like make... We would burn disc for each other.
And right.
We would make our own compilations, pass it around. It'd be like Chastity Summer. Like, you know, right. Like there was a title to. So you're all right. Like, we don't share in that capacity. Now my good buddies will send me their playlist in Spotify. But I'm fortunate enough, being a musician, I'm in the car a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I do get to have that time where I'm like, okay, so for this scene in my life, I'm going to blast these four albums because I have about 6 hours of driving to do. So, but yeah, you're right. We're not having those moments where we're sitting in front of the speaker with the image of the album and the lyrics and the credits. And
I kind of miss that. How about you?
I feel like the specialness has kind of withered away. Mm-hmm. I do think that we have artists that are creating new blueprints to kind of make us enjoy the full album now, in different formats. People like Beyonce or people like even Drake, where when you go to iTunes, you have to purchase the full album and, you know, it says album only. Or when you see Beyonce do the MTV Awards, she'll do her whole album or she'll make a movie out of it so that you can kind of not have the option to skip, but you get the chance to feel the specialness and get the message that they're trying to convey.
But that's, and Chastity, you brought Beyonce's formation, which is what she did, right, mm-hmm. with this album. She really wanted, she kind of set it up so that people had to experience the whole album, right?
Yeah, I mean, she's almost made me, like, crave what MTV used to be, like back in the day when I would sit there literally for hours and watch music videos and have these very visceral experiences. Beyonce has done that through these last two album releases. She's made them full auditory and visual experiences. So yes. I'm hoping in my like high hopes to see more artists that would like share their work with us in like a full-on experience.
Okay, so let's listen to Formation, but then I'm going to come back to that because I'm going to ask you whether that full-on experience matters that much. But here's Formation from Beyonce.
Y'all haters corny with that Illuminati mess. Paparazzi, catch my fly and my cocky fresh. I'm so reckless when I rock my Givenchy dress. I'm so possessive, so I rock his rock necklaces. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama.
Okay, so if I don't hear all of Formation, yep, I'm missing out on some of the stuff that she wanted to communicate, but am I missing out on anything that really matters to my experience of that music?
Yes.
With that song, for sure, yeah.
Why?
First off, it was a very crucial song to come out with, and where she premiered it gave us a special moment, you know, the mm-hmm. Super Bowl. It was like, oh, this is good. Something new, not something that we, you know, that we know or that we can sing. I think she really made the lyrics teach you something and inform you about something that you may not know or that you may know. And I felt like she took a very strategic way, still gave us a beat because we still want to dance. Mm-hmm. We still want to have a good time. I don't want you to inform me and I'm bored. But I think that is one of those songs where you want to listen to the end because there's so much information that you can learn.
Yeah,
to it's put you in formation.
Absolutely. Like Marvin Gaye's What's Going mm-hmm. On hurts. When you listen to the lyrics, it truly,
yes.
At the time it came out for Black people across the country, it hurts. And then you just like, then you find yourself being really swept away in the soul of it. And I feel like, yeah, you're right. Beyonce was able to do that with this one song, come out with some modern day swag and just the bombasticness of her language. But then it's also this kind of call to arms and her stepping up as this like this global artist talking about some very relevant issues.
Absolutely.
But she does it gracefully. You know, because obviously the NFL wouldn't let her, like, so she hit every point right, I feel, in order to be able to share that song on such a public level.
It's equivalent to that song for me, as far as listening to the whole thing, would probably be equivalent to Stevie Wonder's Higher Ground. because it's so much, like, every verse was always like, oh, people, keep on. Okay, well, what are we going to keep on for this time? So I feel like it's like for our generation, it's equivalent, because I listen to Higher Ground now and I'm just like, oh, that's still relevant. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Michael, do you listen to music today and say that speaks to, for lack of not a good word, generation, but that speaks to me in the way that Higher Ground and Marvin Gaye spoke to what was happening in that era?
Yeah, in a totally different way, sort of. But yeah, early 90s, you know, sort of when I was a young, in my 20s.
Yeah.
You know, Nirvana, you know, Pearl Jam, before that Pink Floyd, and you know, now Foo Fighters. Like, there's that tradition of FU rock and roll that I think is also like been a powerful undercurrent that's become main in and out of mainstream various times. And now you see old rock and rollers and they still like wrote the book. When you see people like the Rolling Stones, it's like, yeah, they're old, but they wrote the book. It's been proven out.
Tell me why you brought Kiss. You brought Shout It Out Loud.
I know, it's not a horrible song.
This is actually not what I would have expected from you. No, so
I brought it, if I may.
Yeah, now,
but,
please.
Because I had an argument with my dad when I was a young man. And he was an open-minded person musically in every other way. But he thought Kiss was, you know, garbage. And I sat there and argued with him longer than I've ever argued with him in my life. And he was talking about the great music, you know, Mozart and blah, 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 blah. And saying, you know, what a bunch of disposable crap this was.
Really?
And he should have been right. But he wasn't. Like, Kiss will sort of go down in history because of not so much, right, you know, being great musicians or whatever. But just culturally, really being a rock and roll brand, as Gene Simmons likes to. And just, you know, kind of rewriting the rules in terms of putting face makeup. And that somehow that wasn't that gimmick. Plus some good songs became, you know, multi-generational thing.
So Kiss endures because they figured out how to put like provocative makeup on and didn't write very good music in the end, did they?
I mean, if you look at their hits, they did just fine. Yes, they're the envy of many wannabe rock and rollers. Sure.
Does Kiss endure, before we hear the song, you guys, does Kiss endure for you as anything special that says anything about music?
Not so much.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate, like, when it comes to rock and roll, like, there's different varieties of rock and roll that I appreciate. And I love the theatrics.
Yes.
Like, I love the informality. And, like, what you're talking about, there's just this, like, okay, so there's this set of rules. Now we're going to do, like, this own thing. And we're gonna take the American freak to a whole new level.
You know what I mean?
And that's...
Whole new level.
That's what I dig about them. That's what I appreciate about
this
them.
This was almost like Staying Alive, like...
Yeah.
Type
yeah.
era. So yeah. It was a, you know, a rebellion right. against that, in a
that's
sense.
That's true.
Well.
Okay,
but
let's...
Kiss... Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead, Javon.
Kiss, one thing I will say about them is they were definitely a brand that everyone tries to have now. You don't have to know one song, but you know who Kiss is. You can remember a black and white picture. You can remember something with, you know, their name. They had like a special writing of their name,
but
a font.
But you guys, I think of branding and music as where it started to go wrong.
Really?
Right? I don't hold that up as... And that's, yeah.
For musicians, that's like the marketing world is that's how we're positioned is like, if you have a good song, whatever. What do you look like?
I know, that's what I think is wrong with this.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's listen to the song and then we can talk about that. You just tuned into the Friday Roundtable and thought, what in the hell is going on there? We're talking about music on the Roundtable today. We're taking a little break from the politics, and we've invited three people in who make music and love music and think a lot about music to talk about how we listen today. It's really a conversation that I started back in the spring with Ben Ratliff. He wrote the book about every song ever. So I'm asking this group on the roundtable about how they listen, what's meaningful to them, of the music from their youth and their rites of passage and their lives today. And I'd love to have you tweet in on that. What's the song that turned you into a music listener? You can talk to me about that on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. Okay, Michael Koppel. I should say who the roundtablers are. Michael Koppelman with us. He's a former audio engineer at Paisley Park, now with Badger Hill Brewing. Chastity Brown is here, singer and musician, going out on tour for Red House Records. And Jovante Patton, gospel singer, newest album is called Finally Living. Okay, what else do you want to say about KISS? And then we'll talk about branding and music.
Well, I think there is this continuum between like music as art and music as a widget, you know, people sell.
Yeah.
And you can't get away from the widget side of this if you want to sell records.
Right.
And that's the real conundrum for an artist, is that you're trying to be an artist and yet you realize that you can't be successful without also being good at, you know, the commerce side or the relationship side, whatever you want to call it, playing the game. And hopefully the internet's changing that, where some kid posts stuff to YouTube and gets enough credibility where they do not have to play by the old rules. You know?
Yes.
Right.
That's what we need, and I think it's kind of happening.
You were kind of surprised, Jovante, when I said I think of branding is where some of the industry started to go wrong.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. I agree 100% with you. However, in my agreement, it was kind of great still that branding started at some point, because who would have ever thought we would have Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, where a visual really mattered and where a graphic really matters now, and where it attracts thousands of people at the click of a button, where you don't have to pay anybody to do it. All you have to do is just upload it. So branding at that particular time, with like people like KISS, or even before the internet kind of became so explosive, I can see where branding could have interfered with the art piece. However, now branding is almost neck and neck with the music piece. And so people actually listen to music a whole lot more now because of the internet.
Yeah.
And it allows you to give people their chance. And so, like you said, if you can build a whole entire brand with your followers, then you can rewrite the rules. It's just make sure you just have a brand that looks like it matches the A-listers of now.
What would you say about that, Chastity?
Well, the hippie side of me, even though I've been touring for 10 years, the branding has been really difficult. The framework of that word and the language surrounding it. So what I had to realize, and like this is through the help of like, you know, meeting with marketing people and like people who understood me as a human being and an artist, to get a sense of like, what's my natural aesthetic anyways, like certain themes, like when I'm not touring, I do woodworking and I build things, or I'm obsessed with nature. So like correlating these things that are my interests, because when people say branding, I used to think pop culture, and that any sort of real soul was evaporated from what I was seeing. But now, and like you said, through Instagram and these things that are more controlled by an artist, you can put out something that's authentic and then remove the idea of it being a brand and just think of it as like an extension of myself. Mm-hmm. That's how I have to think about it in order for me to actually do those things that like...
You're kind of saying, you know, when I talk about when we first brought up branding, I thought of kind of how corporate branding works.
Yeah,
and you
totally.
Are saying I can add more dimension to my brand on all these different social media outlets.
Yeah, you can. It's brand now. Branding is more so you speaking for yourself before you get a chance to speak for yourself. If I have an album that comes out and the album is titled Flowers, red flowers are my favorite. Let's put red all around the banners. And when you come to my page, I want a flower here and a flower there. It's almost like it's the brand. So you think of flowers when you think of this record, or you think of this era that this artist is in, but it has more of a connection than just, ooh, let's think of a flower so we can appeal to sell more records. It's more like, no, I love red flowers. And so we decided to use red flowers, and it worked.
It's part of the art, in a sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's like a painter. It's just what you know, graphics have made you be able to convey, if you were like a really good painter, you can kind of just paint it and say, this is what I want. This is what I see when I hear this. Now yes. graphics is more like, I can't paint, but can you get me a dog and a yeah. tambourine? Because that's exactly what I see, you know?
You know, and so, right. Chastity, we were talking about before we came on the air that you're going out on tour for the fourth time with Ani DiFranco.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, she's incredible. But I also feel like she, because of the way the music industry kind of positions mm-hmm. you, she, I think, is in somewhat kind of a musical industry box. And
I mean, she was indie before indie yeah. was even a term wow. in the 90s. And mm-hmm. and maybe Michael can elaborate, but there's an article that I was reading in the Sun magazine about when Prince like was leaving his label and hollered at Ani and was like, how the heck are you an independent, like self-sufficient person? And yeah, and now branding like Righteous Babe, when you think of that, you see that image of the woman like with her arms like beefed up and like kind of like winking, that very like, I forget the name of the image where the woman has on like the bandana.
Yeah,
and, like,
yeah.
Right. You have this like clear cut image, but again, it arose out of that image reflects that she is a self-sufficient artist, entrepreneur. She has her own like regime, like, you know, but she very much kind of set the tone before I think we even realized it, like,
but she's kind of survived beyond the industry brand box, I guess, that they what would you, so you were saying that Ani DiFranco, Prince called Ani DiFranco to say, so how do you do this beyond a label?
Yeah.
I don't recall that exactly, but Prince is an example of someone that, you know, got used to the benefits of the old economy record company-wise.
Right.
So he dabbled in sort of the new economy sort of unsuccessfully, just made his stuff harder to get. And, you know, so I don't know what my point is, except that I think it was too late for him to really cash in on this unless he really revamped himself.
Having worked so long in
and
the
made
industry.
Millions and millions and millions of dollars. Right. You know, it's like once
it's hard.
Madonna, once you get that successful, you start believing your own press and you start hearing him talking about people shouldn't be copying music and stuff like that. You know, things they never thought about until they were wealthy.
Right. Javante, we wanted to play something from your newest album because I want to talk about something else that Ben Ratliff and I discussed when we talked about his book. It's called It's Working.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about making the album before we listen to this.
This album came after I was married and I had just had a daughter, so I really wasn't singing as much.
Uh-huh.
Not because I wasn't getting engagements, but I just kind of wanted to focus on the family and try to be a dad. This dad thing was new, so let me try to focus on being a father. So in that time, I wrote all of these songs and I put my concerns, I put my wish list, I put my how I respond to chaos as being a father. I kind of put it all into an album and I just made it a view of God and myself and how God would treat me if these are my thoughts, you know, toward my child. So this particular record just came from like five rehearsals for it. We recorded it live.
Oh, wow.
And we, you know, did some vocal overdubs and we just finished it and we put it out.
Okay, so this is Javante Patton's It's Working.
Together for my good sake.
All things are working together for my good.
All things are working together for my good sake.
All things come on, are you can say working that. Together for my good.
All things are working together for my good sake.
All things are working together for my good.
When I'm happy,
it's working.
When I'm sad,
it's working.
When things don't work out the way that I planned, all things are working together for my good sake.
All things are working.
You got
together.
Wow, I can feel the energy leap out of the speakers
nice.
On that
oh,
one.
Man.
God, that is good. Javante Patton, the album is called Finally Living, and it went to number one on the Billboard Gospel charts. Yeah, let's get that in.
Yes.
That's gospel music?
I know.
Yes,
okay, that's actually a really good point. That's gospel music?
That's gospel music.
Why? That's not the very traditional kind of gospel music,
absolutely.
Is it?
Absolutely. Definitely not. You know, I had to rewrite the rules, as we talked about earlier, what gospel music was. And gospel music is lyric it's not about a how it should sound as far as what the organ should be doing or how the drum should be played. It's about the lyric. And gospel is scripture. So it's just a scripture that is influenced by, you know, modern day hip hop. You know, I don't want to ever take away from that feel. I love that. That's what I grew up on. Mm-hmm. So it's just a it's just an inclusive, organic project of music that includes everything that I love.
There were gospel singers in the day who were really leery and criticized mm-hmm. for trying to incorporate the music of their day into their gospel music.
The
right?
staple singers. Yeah. I mean, they set the tone for all of that. They were actually the first crossover gospel group in the 50s, and it was really because of Martin Luther King mm-hmm. saw them, then they started performing in a public way, and then their dad was just like, we need to start putting out tracks to everybody and not just singing for the gospel churches, and people were mad, you know, but yeah, years later...
Yeah.
It's Everybody's working. Doing it. Totally. There you go. It sounds great, Javonte.
This is something that that Ben Ratliff says that I thought might apply to you. He says, there's a thing some singers do. They go transparent in their voices. They seem to become the property of other forces. I thought if anybody, a gospel singer, would get that.
Yeah,
does
absolutely.
That make sense to you?
It does. First off, I need to meet this guy. If he comes again,
I'll
let me
book.
Know. I need to buy this book that he speaks yeah. of. But yeah, I mean, you know what? This whole little ride that I've been on, I can agree with that whole entire statement. I'll just leave it there because I can go for like 30 minutes on that alone. So I'll let one of them take it because that is just great.
Okay, so Chastity, the forces that take you up and mm. make your music transparent
yes.
in a way, what happens when that happens?
Well, I mean... My background, I grew up in a Southern gospel church, and when I began writing Parted Ways from, like, religion and things like that, but what I took and what I was taught was that you sing from your gut. You sing, it's this emotiveness that is soul music, where you just literally feel like you're an open container just being dumped out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like at the church I grew up in, it was like music could be 2-3 hours and there would be no preaching, you know? And so I just thought that was how music was done. And that's why the other fella that I wrote down for today is Van Morrison. Because
you hear that in Van Morrison. You hear the open container and
yeah,
they
it's the,
being
the Irish
out.
Dudes. There's some Irish. I mean, and the ladies. I think Irish music is just very akin to soul music, where they're just like barreling out. Like it's like they can't open their mouths wide enough to get the darn words out. And I really respond to that. And I feel that when I sing, and it's taken me a long time to craft the way I sing in order to handle that much emotion. Like I used to just scream because I couldn't. And now I'm like, oh, I can actually sing my emotion. You know, it was like a craft thing. But early on, I was just like,
And was that know? Was that the result of someone saying to you from the outside, externally saying, it's just not as moving or effective when you're screaming this? Or did you get that?
I knew that, but I didn't have... at that point, I was like 22, 23, and I just didn't have the insight. And it was a harsh critique that came out in a local newspaper when I first moved here. And
thank you, Star Tribune.
No, well, it was, I forget. Yeah, it was either... it was Dwight Hobbs was the critic.
We always remember the right.
Oh
the,
yeah, Star Tribune has said some things, and we'll talk about that off air. But he just said he commented on my lyrics, which were fine, and then he was just like, every time she gets to an emotion part of the song, you don't know what she's saying because she's screaming the whole time. And I was so offended. Mm. And then after I like let my ego deflate a little bit, I realized that he was completely correct. And I started to go to vocalists in town that I admire and was like, teach me what I don't know. Because I do want to say something. I do want to sing something. I'm vocally trained. I know how to, but I don't know how to do it when I'm starting to feel something, that thing that happens when you're live on stage. Every live performer knows that feeling, but can't pinpoint it. So I had to go back to the shed, as it said, and learn how to articulate via like notes, like what I want to do.
So is that something we hear in this song that you chose from Van Morrison, Cypress Avenue?
Yeah, because, oh my God. I mean, that, as you said, Javante, I could go on and on, but like exactly, there's parts in this song, like we might not hear it all, but Yonder Come My Lady with Rainbow Ribbons in Her Hair, the way he sings that line slays. So this whole album, I would highly recommend Astro Weeks to listen to from the beginning to the end, because it's one of those things, like, it just, he just lets loose like a barrel, like the whole track.
Well, I'm caught one more time up on Cypress Avenue. Caught one more time up on Cypress Avenue. And I'm conquered in a car seat. Nothing that I can do.
It's Van Morrison and Cypress Avenue, and one of the songs that one of our roundtablers brought to the conversation today about music, how we listen, what moves us, how that changes. That's the roundtable today, taking a little break from politics. We'll get a look at the latest news and continue our conversation about music.
And good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. Donald Trump's son says his father recognizes President Obama was born in the U.S., but he doesn't know if his father will say so himself. On ABC this morning, Donald Trump Jr. pointed to a statement by the campaign acknowledging Obama's U.S. birth, saying the statement should be the definitive end of questions about Trump's views. One of the most powerful Syrian opposition groups in the northern province of Aleppo is denying government forces have withdrawn from a main road leading into rebel-held parts of Syria's largest city. The group says in a statement, its observation posts in the area are confirming government forces are still on the road. It is accusing the government of not giving permission for the UN to deliver trucks of aid to besieged neighborhoods in Aleppo. A suicide bombing in a mosque in northwest Pakistan has killed at least 16 worshippers and wounded 25 others. A government official says the attack happened today in a village in Pakistan's Mohammed tribal region. No one has immediately claimed responsibility for that attack. The UN says South Sudan has joined Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia in producing more than 1 million refugees. South Sudan gained independence from Sudan in 2011, but civil war erupted 2 years later, and tens of thousands have been killed. New fighting in July in the capital, Juba, created a surge of more than 185,000 refugees. The case of two slain nuns is on today's agenda in a Mississippi courtroom. Prosecutors will present evidence against 46-year-old Rodney Sanders before taking the case to a grand jury. He is charged with capital murder in the deaths of sisters Margaret Held and Paula Merrill. They worked as nurse practitioners in one of the poorest counties in the nation. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is nearing 9:40.
Later on All Things Considered, it's Friday, so our resident pundits process the week in politics, and then the Cube critics set your silver screen agenda. I'm Tom Kranitz. Our Friday pair of pairs and all the day's news. Join me on Minnesota Public Radio News starting at 3.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11 on NPR News, our next installment of Counter Stories, a regular conversation by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. Today, a lot of focus on the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's at 11.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
programming is supported by At Sarah's Table Chester Creek Cafe, featuring local organic produce, meats, and fish with vegetarian, vegan, and gluten-free options, fair trade coffees, and Anahata teas at 19th Avenue East and 8th Street in Duluth.
Straight up, don't blame you. You're not the cash and I'm not the jewel. Never be the one to make you better. Whatever.
It's the Friday Roundtable, and we're talking about listening to music and making music with three people for whom music is a big deal. Chastity Brown is with us, Jovante Patton is with us, and Michael Koppelman. Michael, you brought that song to the Roundtable. Why? Why did you bring in? First of all, I've always thought when I've heard that song that it's Taylor Swift for some reason.
It does give you a little Taylor.
Yeah. Tell me what you hear in that.
Well, I think it's interesting that she wrote that with some country music writers.
Oh, I didn't know
she
that.
She thinks it's a country song.
Like
it's
not, really? But
you can see, you know, the dance elements. It's obviously a pop song.
Yeah.
It's not that deep of a song.
Right.
But she started off as a sort of self-distributing musician who got some songs in commercials and on like Grey's Anatomy, this and that.
Is that what happened?
She didn't have a label.
Okay.
As far as I know, I don't know her personally, but, you know, she made a ton of money by doing this new economy thing of just essentially not needing a label.
Right.
And started off sort of as a, I don't know, a teen girl type artist, you know, appealing to, I don't know what that demographic's called, you know, like Sarah Bareilles type thing.
Yeah, right.
Moving into, you know, pop. And you see artists make these transitions. And I don't know, to me, she's a great songwriter. I like pop songs. Mm-hmm. So what's your problem with it,
Miller? So do I. It just, you know what my problem is with it? I sense that, and I think this is something you just alluded to, there's more to her. I hear kind of the potential of what she could do with that. And I feel like when I hear that song, it's a lazy thing for her to get some attention and money. Nothing wrong with that. But then I kind of go, where's the real thing? Right.
I mean, that Ingrid Michaelson does. The craft of that, though, I would defend as,
yeah,
you know, people try their whole lives to make songs that good, knowing it's a pop song. It's not a deep song.
Yeah, got
but
it.
But just that, you know, it's a lot harder than it seems. You think you can sort of just make, throw, maybe
that's
music.
A good point.
That's great.
Right?
And it's never great.
As somebody who does not make music, you're right. That sounds to me like, oh, she probably wrote that in like, you know, 15 minutes and it's got a catchy beat. And Chastity, what would you say to this?
Oh, yeah. I have two things to say. One is, as an artist, if you listen to my voice memos right now, for one, you'd truly know that I'm ADD. But the second thing that you would hear is that the songs that I'm writing are all different styles.
Mm-hmm.
And I get so excited about a synth line with this like crazy, like, vibrating bass part, or then I get really excited about just an acoustic guitar on the front porch talking about the birds. And so as an artist, I think we all crave like just lending our voice and like just seeing how we would respond in this like atmosphere, whether it be a pop atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of lends to, sometimes I truly just want to be playful. And
absolutely,
oftentimes, if you look at the body of my work, and even my most current work, it's some really tender and emotional themes. And immediately after writing 10 songs like that, I'll write something that has no depth, that is just about like
have
jumping
fun
around. I'm talking about the stars in some sort of like vague ethereal way. And so sometimes these songs are, as an artist, it's just a counterbalance to like what we were writing before.
Absolutely.
I just want to say one thing here. I'm so glad you used the word playful, because I had a note, Michael, with you having worked with Prince. He was the consummate musician, I guess, who understood that imaginative playfulness, right? Which never took away, I guess, from this depth that he could channel too.
Yeah, totally. And also very serious in a sense, like he's respected as a serious musician.
Right.
You know, the sex side of his music,
yeah,
and yet the God side. It's like a
right,
very complex, yes, picture that gets painted of him, you
yeah
know, which
yeah
is correct.
Jovante?
You know what? I have such a huge kind of thought on that. I feel like sometimes we box each other in, or we box, you know, artistry in, and it's like everybody doesn't have to be a civil rights, you know, movement singer mm-hmm. when they make an album. Mm-hmm. Some people, you know, they just want to go and have fun, and it's like everybody has a place. Everybody has a voice. And so I've thought about it. There are some songs I just don't want to hear at the club. There's some songs I just don't want to go to a two-hour concert of, you know, almost like watching a lecture, boring black and white movie on a Saturday afternoon. It's okay to have the fun songs. And I think people, they don't think outside of their daily issues. Mm-hmm. That's why we as a country can sometimes get so stressed, because it's like, it's okay. It's okay to sing about 99 bottles of beer on the wall. It's okay, you know? And so I just like the like Prince was. You saw the fun side, you saw the God side, you saw the sex side, and it lets you know that he's not one-dimensional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really astonishing that he was able to bring that together in such a seamless way.
And be comfortable with it. I mean,
right.
Just even his presentation, it lets you know that he was comfortable with the lyric and
That's
he
right.
was very convicted by the lyric. So
yeah, I feel like my judgment when I'm listening to new music, and again, this my judgment, but mm-hmm. I feel like that's what I want. I want to know that someone is being their authentic self, and I further judge that when I see someone live. Like, are you just totally consumed with what the F it is you're doing right now? Because that ignites me. Like,
what are the tells for you when that is happening?
Well, I think there's a couple different tells depending on the style of music. The sense of control, I would say Chani from Palisa has a very tender and playful control of the way she performs, whereas someone like Ani DeFranco, you can just see her be like so connected with the musicians she's playing with, the lyrics that she's delivering to the audience. There's just something that, you know, as an audience member there, that the person you're seeing is also experiencing something
mm-hmm.
like, you know, and there's just something contagious about that. And then, yeah, I mean, I'm a very harsh critic when it comes to lyrics, because I'm a singer songwriter and mm-hmm. that's where, you know, my vibe is. But, I think overall, like, I just want people to be authentic, whether it's pop music or grunge.
But what you just said, I think, is really important about the power of the live performance. And I think this is present in music. It's present in an interview kind of format in which I do it, in which the audience has a sense that this isn't all kind of predestined, what I'm going to say
yeah.
and what they're going to say and how you're going to sing it and the song that you're going to sing, that there really is something serendipitous and unexpected going on.
Yeah, there's room to be surprised. Either you're
right.
surprising yourself as the orchestrator of what's happening, or you're being surprised as an audience member.
But I mean, this kind of takes us back to the beginning. I think that experience is rarer and rarer because we curate so much of what we're exposed to, right? There isn't a whole lot of surprise when you download 8 songs and you know exactly, and you listen to them over and over again, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Michael?
I think it's funny that with motion pictures, you know, we know it's utterly contrived. Like, if they make you cry, it's because they tried as hard as they could to with like 10
exactly.
or $100 million.
Right.
And with music, any, you know, recorded piece of music is contrived in the same sense. Mm-hmm. We obsess over every note music, when things are muted and how loud and what side. You know, like, it's a ton of attention to detail to make this thing as powerful as it can be emotionally.
Right.
You know, so it is contrived. And yet we feel like it is genuine on the part of an artist. And it is. I'm not saying it's not. And yet with a movie, you know, not so much. It's more of an enterprise that makes a movie.
Right.
You know, with a record, we want to ultimately believe that this is their soul
right.
speaking to
right.
us.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually is, you know. Sometimes yeah. it's not.
Yeah. Javante, I think this would be a good time to listen to the other song that you brought with you, Kirk Franklin's
yes.
Stomp. Because I mean, that's a good example of what Michael just described. He's probably performed whatever version we're going to hear today many, many, many times. But somehow he accesses that thing that isn't totally predictable.
Absolutely. Every time it's always, I just seen him do Stomp probably in the April, I think it was. And it still was like, and this song is like 15, 16 years old. You know, it's that unpredictable just mannerism or thing that happens, that special thing that we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. that is still grabbing you to love it.
Let's hear it.
You better put them hands together and act like you know up in here. Chief Pete.
Go ahead and sing along. Go right ahead.
Sounds like Prince.
It does. Yeah. So was that song important to you you said it's 16 years old. So it was an up and coming.
Actually, I was younger than that. Stomp came out in like 99, 2000.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Juvenile Back That Thing Up time. So I was nine or 10. I was really young.
Okay. So tell me.
Actually, you know, I was 7. I take that back. That CD came out.
I was a junior in high school.
Yeah, that was like 97. I was 7. That it held so much in our household because here's the fun part about that particular record, that song. That was such a redefining moment for gospel music at the time because it had such a beat. It was being played in clubs. And so we had the Staples Centers. We had singers. We had Andre Crouch, who kind of did those different things. But now we had Kirk Franklin, mm-hmm. who was going against the grain. And so a lot of churches didn't even receive it. And what's so funny about it now is that that's a normal style church song now.
Like I remember it was on MTV. They were all was in like a white suit. And
absolutely. On the basketball courts. Salt and Pepper was a part of it.
Right.
And so for me being 7 years old, I liked it because my sisters liked it. Mm-hmm. So when my sisters listened to new stuff, they was banging their head to it. So my mom, who had teenage girls, you know, let me get into whatever. If it has something to do with God and they want to be a part of it, we're going to root this in our house. But the genius part that stood out to me with Kirk Franklin was that was only one song on the record. The rest of the record was traditional church music.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So it was almost like this trick to get him in mainstream and to get all these sales and to be this Billboard chart topping artist, but still be true to who he was.
Okay, so I get the feeling that as you that this is a song that was really important to your self image as somebody that would eventually
come
be
and do
singing
the same
gospel
thing.
Music,
yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely, and even today, I mean, my song "It's Working." Those two songs still fit on a radio playlist back to back. All right, Stomp it in such and such. So it was so influential that still today that sound is being recreated by a 7-year-old at the time who's now 26.
That's right, right.
You know?
So, Chastity, what's the song that, not one of your own, what's the song that was out there that you would say, my image today was shaped in some way by that song?
Oh, wow. There's so many different complexities of my childhood, like, because my mom, as far as she knew, we only listened to gospel.
Bingo.
But I too had an older sister and an older brother. My brother was like spinning nothing but Southern rap because, you know, mm-hmm. we grew up in Tennessee. And then my sister was playing like Luther Vandross, like TLC, like all these different things. But then there was this whole other world that I started getting into, like Dave Matthews mm-hmm. and David Gray and Alanis Morissette. And so I honestly don't have like this, I think, specific thing, because also being a biracial person, I identify with identify with Dolly Parton as much as I do Mavis Staples, you know, wow. And like that is I'm half Irish, half Black. And that's so I gravitate to both of those worlds. And just I feel like to maybe better answer your question, it's like the music of the South really influences me. The songwriters and the roots and blues and that again, that type of honesty. You know, and I feel like as I tried so hard not to be that type of artist when I moved to Minnesota, and lo and behold, I am exactly what I grew up on. Like there's no surprise. It's like, yeah.
So, Michael, the song that you would say, you know, when I think about who I became and why I love music, this song plays a pretty big part of it. What is it?
I mean, that's an impossible question, as you know, but, you know, to me, what's interesting about music, if I do a prelude to that question, is that the music talks before the lyrics do, the intellectual part of the song. You can hear a song in a foreign language and cry without having
that's
any
right.
idea, you know, what the lyrics mean. I listen to songs for decades without knowing lyrics. Like, it's not the important part of music to me. They're very important. Like, I love well-crafted lyrics. And once I dig into the lyrics, it's like an extra surprise for me, like, because I already knew what the song was about. Like, the music told me what the song was about.
Uh-huh.
But the lyrics are, like, I don't know, icing on top somehow. But so as a, you know, white dude, it was like Pink Floyd, Comfortably Numb type thing of, like, mm-hmm. I remember, like, changing my life type feeling. Like, just felt like it validated your alienation from all of humanity. But then, like, Prince, you know, I saw Purple Rain, and, you know, that record got me into a whole lifestyle really that I wouldn't have had otherwise without Prince, you know, doing Purple Rain. So
right.
the fact that I went on to work with him made it even more so that, you know, like that his influence to me is profound on me and, you know, everybody.
I think those are two pretty good choices.
Yeah.
Pink Floyd and Prince, right? For an impossible question, right? Okay, so we're going to close with Dolly Parton of all artists here, Chastity, awesome. That you brought up as being influential to you.
Yeah, I mean, Dolly just has this very classic story of, like, perseverance. But then I had a friend of mine talking about, when we were talking earlier about sitting down, she took a Dolly Parton album, slowed it down, and decreased it to where Dolly sounds like she's singing a tenor. And all of her arrangements, including The Great Pretender, sound like a straight-up Mahalia Jackson tune. Like, except, you know, Dolly's voice is such at a frequency, like so high pitched. But yeah, The Great Pretender, I just think the arrangement, it's just a beautiful tune.
Hey, thank you all for a roundtable with some impossible questions that you found answers to.
Thank you.
Really great thanks, to have
it
you
was
here.
Fun. Thank you for having me back. We can talk about other stuff.
Will do. Will do.